private housing markets can and should be the vehicle of choice for helping all racial and ethnic groups in their quest for socioeconomic upward mobility.
Not only must the government now foster integration, but also investment and resource growth in existing black neighborhoods.
Profit trumps prejudice.
We should stop subsidizing homeowners with mortgage interest deductions if their communities fail to embrace desegregation.
A private but well-policed housing market is actually the best way to penalize racism and foster integration, and the best way to enable all racial and ethnic groups to strive for financial security and upward mobility through home ownership.
Remediation should include a mixed-income public housing program with apartments affordable to black and white families of various means.
I'm confused as to why Richard, having given us this powerful litany of government-created problems, has so much faith in the government to redress them.
Opportunities for integration and investments in existing black neighborhoods are needed, and the private sector is incapable of fostering either. Only government can do so.
Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Todd Cranen. For over a century, local and federal governments fostered housing segregation by abandoning black communities and depriving them of essential resources. The Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration pursued openly racist policies to limit the housing market for blacks while suburbanizing the urban white working class. At the local level, exclusionary zoning laws were separating households by race as early as the 1870s. How should the 21st century repair the legacy of segregation established in the 20th? Two housing policy experts debated whether governments have a mandate to fix the problem they created or whether private markets would do the best job of integration. The debate was hosted by the Soho Forum. It pit Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, against Howard Husok, author of The $1 trillion Housing Mistake, The Failure of American Housing Policy. The debate was held on January 14th, 2019, at the Subculture Theater in New York City. Gene Epstein moderated.
Welcome to this fifth debate of the third season of the Soho Forum at the Subculture Theater in downtown Manhattan. I'm Gene Epstein, director of the Soho Forum. Tonight's resolution reads, since the federal government fostered housing segregation in the 20th century, the government should foster housing integration in the 21st. The Columbia Journalism Review ran a profile of Jacobin Mag editor Bhaskar Sankara, which mentioned me and my Soho Forum debate with Bhaskar, but said virtually nothing about the substance of the debate, except that I yelled at Bhaskar, walk the walk, and quit talking the talk. The profile was written by Matthew David Roberts, who had attended the debate. So I wrote a letter to the editor explaining that I had meant something quite specific when I urged Bhaskar to walk the walk. And I provided a link to the podcast and to the video of our debate, which has so far gotten over 36,000 YouTube views. You might want to have a look at it if you haven't already. Now, from the story in Columbia Journalism Review, there was also this mention. Before the debate began, a comedian in an unzipped hoodie warmed up the crowd with jokes about Me Too and Bernie Sanders. Shortly after, an ill-considered crack about hungry Africans earned him a few boos from the audience. He said, I'm sorry if I stereotyped Africa, he told his hecklers, but was not sorry at all. That was Dave Smith. Here tonight. Since we last saw Dave at our debate in early December, he's become a father to a baby girl named Layla. Apparently the first half of his podcast, Part of the Problem, is devoted to accounts of what Layla has recently been up to. But now we want to bring you the guy in the unzipped hoodie who probably won't be sorry tonight about offending us, Dave Smith.
Thank you, Gene. Hey, what's up, everybody? Wow, that was my favorite intro that you've ever given me. The unzipped hoodie part, like the jokes would have been cool if I had just zipped up the hoodie. That is 2019. I'm being made fun of for dressing like shit from communists. That's what we're dealing with now. Is there like, get some fashion sense. Whatever happened to the communists of yesteryear who would just always dress like crap, right? Wasn't that their thing? I don't know. That was a great debate. That was a lot of fun. My wife will sometimes still, she'll just be walking around our place, and just randomly, she'll just go, learn some economics, Bhaskar, and we both just laugh, and laugh, and laugh. That was... And did I didn't apologize for stereotyping Africa. What's the point of Africa if you can't stereotype it? I'm sorry, I referred to Africa as being poor. You're right, they're a very wealthy continent. I never should have done that. It's just nothing but skyscrapers and mini mansions over there. Anyway, I don't know. I appreciate all of you guys could come out, make it out during this government shutdown. I know it was very difficult for you to get on with your life knowing that the TSA agents aren't being paid this week. It's just, I wake up every morning and cry a tear for those wonderful people. I'm like, I can't believe I might actually make a flight on time and not get groped today. This is just, how are we going to go on like this? I hate those guys. I'm so thrilled they're not being paid. I fly a lot because I'm a comedian. That's like part of the job. And every time, I think they know I'm a libertarian. Like, they fuck with me every single time I get on. The last time I flew, they go, you've been randomly selected. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And they go, you've been randomly selected for like an extra scrutiny or something. I don't know. And then he was like, we have to give you like a fuller pat down than we normally give people. And this TSA agent, I'm not making this up, this is real. He goes, if you feel more comfortable, we can do it in a private room. And I was like, we will do it right here in front of everybody. Like, what, do you want to crack a window and light a candle? I want witnesses to whatever's happening here. What are you talking? I was like, yeah, really, if we could maybe play some Kenny G and then like get, anyway, I don't know. I'm the most unprepared I've ever been for one of these things. I'm exhausted, as Gene said. I just had a baby. She's 5 weeks old now. Oh, thank you. She's actually a racist, so I wouldn't clap that much for her. She's not a good person. But I told her about the debate, and she's like, you ask me, we should bring back segregation. And I was like, Layla, that's hateful. But she don't care. But anyway, it's really great to have a baby. It's amazing. It's challenging. I'm very tired. If someone gave me a pillow, I could sleep right here in front of all you people with no problem. That none of the noise or lights would bother me. I would just... It's a trip. It's a trip having a baby. They're very demanding, and they don't do anything. They contribute nothing to society. They don't cook or clean. They don't bring any money in. You have to do everything. You have to change them and wipe their ass. And then for all of that, they just yell at you when you do something wrong. Like, they don't even throw you a thanks, Pop. It's just like yelling and screaming. I don't know. It's a very weird dynamic. I was up till 7:30 in the morning last night. She's like a terrorist. She's such a terrorist. I'm surprised the CIA isn't sending her weapons. Like, I just think they could really use her to overthrow a regime abroad or something. But anyway, it's a lot. I don't know. But I'm here. But here we are. A debate on you know, we're going to solve all of the problems of the history of racism in this country. And who better to do it than a couple of Jews? Am I right? Like, who else? I don't even mean that sarcastically. If we were going to solve racism, wouldn't it really be a couple of Jews who would figure this thing out? Am I right? I know what you're thinking. Dave, you're a Jew too. But actually, since our last debate, I have started identifying as a Filipino woman. So that's offensive to me. I'm also 86 and collecting Social Security. So back off is what I'm trying to say. Thank you, one person. All right. It's cool. Take what you will. I don't know. The government imposed segregation, so maybe they should impose integration now. I'll go further. I don't think that's enough. I think we should enslave white people for 200 years just to really even the playing field up, all right? And then in 2219, we'll be like, even freedom. Let's go. You know, like, let's really, now we're all on the same. But maybe that's not enough. I think the Japanese should get to intern a bunch of wasps, you know, take a bunch of their property. And Jews can kill as many Germans as they can find. Just go to town until you feel even. I don't even know. You'll never get enough. So just kill as many as you want to. Does that sound good? No? Do we not solve the problem? Or no? Okay. I'm sorry. You can't expect these jokes to be as good with the government shut down. I get a lot of my inspiration knowing that the government is fully functional and open. I think these, I love a government shutdown. I love it. I think it's like everyone, these are the times when it's best to convince people that, as it turns out, we don't need a government. Like, it's, everything's normal, right? We could just do this all the time. Wouldn't it be awesome? I remember saying this once during the last government shutdown, not the last Trump one, the last one under Obama. So this was a while ago. And I was like, who even cares? This is awesome, having the government shut down. And one woman in the crowd got really offended, much like those commies. And she goes, I care that the government shut down. And I was like, really? Why? And she goes, I'm a government employee. And I was like, oh yeah, you're the people who care that it's shut down. You're the only people that care. But I was like, okay, fair enough. You're a government employee. You don't want it to be shut down. So I was like, what do you do for the government? And she said to me, so proud, she said, I work for the Department of Wildlife. And I was like, lady, I'm going to be honest. I didn't even know we had a Department of Wildlife. How many useless departments are there in this overbloated government? They've got things I've never even heard of. There's a Department of Wildlife. Wildlife. The one area that you would think doesn't need government intervention at all. Wildlife. That's what this woman was throwing at me. Like, you know what the wildlife is doing right now during the government shutdown? I don't know. I'd assume they're continuing to be wildlife. I don't think somewhere deep in the forest there's like a bear who's like, have you heard from Susan? Like, we usually get an email around this time. I don't even know what I should be doing today. I'm just going to sit here until I get some marching orders, because you think this is about that wall? You really think? Trump is just hilarious. I don't know. I don't really care about the wall. I don't really care one way or the other. Like, I don't think it's an outrage, and I don't really want it. I don't really care. I think it's stupid, but I think Trump's hilarious. I saw him interviewed earlier today, and he said, we're going to have a terrific wall, and we already have a lot of terrific wall, and it'll just be terrific. And I was just like, I think I'm sold. I don't know. Like, this, I think this guy's just hypnotized me into his insanity, where I'm like, all right, I guess it's good. Like, so I'm just tired. I haven't been sleeping. I'm like, I think that made sense to me. I don't know. Like, you know, someone's asking me, they're like, what about the wall? I'm like, I think it's going to be terrific. I don't really remember. Like, I can't wait for the 2020 election. I just can't wait to see him debate more. Like, I love that Elizabeth Warren's running. I hope she wins. I think that them debating would just be amazing. How hilarious is Trump that he just goaded her into that stupid DNA test? And she just looks like an idiot. Donald Trump goes, if Elizabeth Warren takes a DNA test, I'll give her $1 million. And then she took it, and she's like, I guess you owe me $1 million. And then, like, reporters asked him, they were like, so are you going to pay her $1 million? And he was like, no. And that's just the end of it. Like, he was like, what, you took that seriously? Of course I'm not paying her anything. All right, enjoy the debate, everybody. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm going to go sleep.
All right, thank you, sir.
Dave Smith, I'm a huge fan of his Part of the Problem broadcast, and you want more of that, listen to Part of the Problem podcast is what I should call it. Well, again, the resolution is, since the federal government fostered housing segregation in the 20th century, the government should foster housing integration in the 21st. Taking the affirmative on the resolution is Richard Rothstein. Richard, please come to the stage. Taking the negative on the resolution, Howard Husak. Howard, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. And now that the voting is closed, Richard, whenever you have a moment, please take the podium and speak for the affirmative on the resolution. Take it away, Richard.
Thank you, Gene. When you invited me for this even-handed, serious debate, I had no idea you were going to open it with an offensive, bigoted, so-called comedy presentation. And I would have not have accepted this invitation had I known that you were going to do that. But I'm here, so I will begin the serious part of this conversation. The debate premise is that government fostered segregation in the 20th century. I'll expand it a bit. Our government, and the word our here is critical, not only fostered segregation, but a racial caste system that not only segregated African Americans, but deprived them of equal opportunity to earn income and acquire wealth, to enjoy personal security and civil rights. These interacted. Segregation cannot be remedied in isolation. I'll also reframe the debate challenge. Not only must the government now foster integration, but also investment and resource growth in existing black neighborhoods, because greater racial equality is a precondition of opportunities for integration. Italians, Jews, other ethnics, and increasingly Asians and Hispanics can now choose to live almost anywhere in metropolitan areas. Those who choose to remain clustered in mostly same ethnic neighborhoods are not consigned, as are many African Americans, to live in ghettos without access to jobs or transportation to access those jobs, or under-resourced schools or basic civil rights, such as the right to personal security, without undergoing capricious arrests or searches. Opportunities for integration and investments in existing black neighborhoods are needed, and the private sector is incapable of fostering either. Only government can do so. In my book, The Color of Law, I describe many policies enacted by federal, state, and local governments to segregate African Americans and to press them into a lower caste without economic or civil resources. The Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration pursued racially explicit policy to suburbanize the urban white working class into all white suburbs. The iconic one here in New York, Levittown, William Levitt could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes, none pre-sold, in one place. No bank would lend for such a speculative activity. Levitt could only proceed by pledging to the Federal Housing Administration never to rent or sell to African Americans. The FHA even required Levitt to place a clause in home deeds prohibiting resale to African Americans. Only then would the FHA guarantee Levitt's bank loans. This was not the action of rogue bureaucrats. The policy was spelled out in the FHA manual that barred appraisers from referring integrated subdivisions for federal insurance. The manual even banned guarantees for all white projects located near black neighborhoods because they ran a, quote, risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups, unquote. There were thousands of these developments nationwide. One was Westlake, south of San Francisco, described in the song about little boxes on a hillside made of ticky-tacky. In Los Angeles, Panorama City, Lakewood, and Westchester symbolized suburbanization. All had federally imposed bans on black families. Homes in these all-white suburbs were modest, selling for about $100,000 in today's inflation-adjusted money, easily affordable to working-class families of either race. For war veterans, down payments were waived. Many African Americans with jobs in the post-war boom could have afforded these homes. More could have done so if they had not served in unconstitutionally segregated armed forces that consigned them to lower-paying ranks and jobs. And if state and federal employment agencies had not honored employer requests to reject black applicants. Even more could have done so, afforded to move to these suburbs, if our government in the 1960s, up until the 1960s, had not certified closed shops and construction unions that barred black workers from membership. African Americans were not only prohibited from living in suburbs, they were prohibited from the lucrative opportunities to participate in their construction. Over the next few generations, as you know, working class suburban homes appreciated in value. They now sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, in some places more. White families, subsidized by government to buy into this bargain market, gained wealth from growing appreciation. They used it to send children to college, to subsidize retirement, to weather temporary unemployment or medical emergencies, to invest in remodeling that further increased housing value, and, most important, to bequeath wealth to children and grandchildren who then had down payments for their own homes. Today, suburbs are unaffordable to working and middle-class families of either race unless they have down payment support from prior generations' gifts or bequests. Average African-American incomes are now 60% of whites, but average black wealth is only 10% of whites.
That enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional and unremedied federal policy that we, all of us as American citizens, have an obligation to remedy. I mentioned public housing. It was not originally for the poor. Our first projects were built as the Great Depression, in the Great Depression, by the New Deal, to provide jobs to construction workers and housing for working families with stable employment. We did have 25% unemployment in the Depression, but public housing was for the employed 75% who could afford housing, but who lacked it because home building was feeble. The Federal Public Works Administration and local agencies used public housing to rigidify racial segregation where it already existed and to create segregation where it did not. In the mid-20th century, many urban neighborhoods were integrated because industry and supporting services located mostly downtown, close to river ports or railroad stations to receive parts or ship final products. Workers of all ethnicities and both races, Italian, Irish, Polish, Jewish, African American, didn't have cars to walk to work, so lived in broadly the same neighborhoods from which they could walk or take short streetcar rides to jobs. The great African-American poet Langston Hughes described growing up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood where his local high school, his best friend was Polish, and his girlfriend Jewish. The Public Works Administration demolished integrated housing there to build separate projects, one for whites, one for African-Americans, creating segregation there and reinforcing it elsewhere in Cleveland with other segregated projects. The pattern was repeated nationally. In my book, The Color of Law, I describe some self-satisfied, smug places, not just New York, but Cambridge, Berkeley, and other places like that. In Cambridge, Central Square, the area between Harvard and MIT, was integrated in the 1930s, about half black and half white. The Public Works Administration demolished housing there to build one project for whites and one for blacks. These and other Boston projects created segregation that otherwise would never have developed so rigidly. In the West, African Americans were few prior to the second great migration of World War II. Then, a small suburb of Berkeley, Richmond, became a great Pacific Ocean shipbuilding center, drawing 100,000 workers and their families from outside the region. The government built public housing for these workers, for blacks, temporary and shoddy housing along the railroad tracks, and for whites, better housing in white residential areas with access to shopping. How did public housing become the slums that we now associate with it? As the FHA subsidized white suburban moves, white-designated public housing emptied out. But there were long waiting lists for black-designated projects. Soon, all were open to African Americans. Even the most bigoted officials couldn't justify empty projects while others had long waiting lists. Public housing became mostly black. At about the same time, new highways let industry get parts and ship products by truck. So they no longer needed to be located near deepwater ports, and they located to suburbs and rural areas. As good industrial jobs left downtown, black public housing residents became poorer, and their rents had to be subsidized, no longer adequate to cover apartments' full rent. With public housing no longer self-supporting, housing agencies reduced maintenance and projects deteriorated. Then, in a great policy misjudgment, well-intentioned housing officials decided that the poorest applicants' needs were so enormous that middle-class residents should be evicted to make room for the poor. Housing authorities inspected apartments, searching for husbands whose income made their families ineligible to stay. Thus, projects concentrated the poorest families, frequently single mothers, in buildings that were once mixed income and healthy. Segregation that we, our government, imposed and reinforced underlies our most serious social problems today. The achievement gap between black and white school children reflects the concentration of disadvantaged minority children into racially homogenous schools where their social and economic problems overwhelm even the best teachers. Great health disparities reflect life in more polluted neighborhoods and poorly maintained housing, lower black life expectancy and higher disease rates, for example. Mass incarceration, disproportionately of young black men, reflects the concentration of the most hopeless youths in isolated neighborhoods with little access to jobs and educations.
I have already mentioned the enormous wealth gap between blacks and whites that locks many African Americans into rented apartments, either in the private market or in public housing, located in under-resourced neighborhoods. Yet another result of segregation is our dangerous political polarization that closely tracks racial lines and threatens our very future as a democracy. If so many blacks and whites live so far apart that we lack any empathy for each other's life experiences, how can we ever create a common national identity? My book, The Color of Law, brings together many public policies that, in violation of the 5th, 14th, even the 13th Amendments, created and reinforced segregation. Each of the separate policies was well known to the public, to scholars, and certainly to housing experts like my opponent here tonight. For example, the FHA's all-white suburban program was publicized by Kenneth Jackson's widely read 1985 book, Crabgrass Frontier, with many subsequent authors recounting the same story. Yet in 2003, Howard inexplicably described it in the Manhattan Institute's City Journal like this, quote, "As the U.S. economy boomed after World War II, the lower middle class working families for whom the public housing projects had been built discovered that they could afford privately built homes in America's burgeoning suburbs, and by the 1960s they had completely abandoned public housing. Left behind were the poorest, most disorganized, non-working families, almost all of them headed by single women." And he then went on to explain that disorganization, lack of work ethic, and single motherhood is all that locked and continues to lock African Americans into under-resourced ghetto neighborhoods. It's hard for me to understand how serious attempts to remedy racial segregation, whether public or private, can proceed with such a sanitized understanding of how we got here. But I'm anxious, as you are, to hear how Howard proposes to reverse the disaster for which previous administrations were responsible without government remedies. I think that remediation requires subsidies to African Americans comparable to the wealth bequests that descendants of World War II veterans received, and that will enable African Americans now to buy homes in suburbs or to purchase and upgrade homes in existing black communities that they otherwise would have been able to purchase 50 and 60 years ago. Remediation should include a mixed-income public housing program with apartments affordable to black and white families of various means. It should include a ban on exclusionary zoning, a ban on exclusionary zoning that keeps many suburbs overwhelmingly white. It should include inclusionary zoning so that gentrifying neighborhoods don't convert from low-income black segregated places into high-income white segregated places. Also, to ensure that gentrification does not create reverse segregation, it should include property tax freezes for existing homeowners in those neighborhoods. We should stop subsidizing homeowners with mortgage interest deductions if their communities fail to embrace desegregation. We should stop using tax credits and vouchers only to concentrate low-income minority families in distressed neighborhoods and instead use these programs as desegregation tools. We should vastly increase funding of schools, health services, and social workers in low-income neighborhoods. There's much more we could do, none of which is presently on the political horizon. So, Howard, I hope you can agree that letting bygones be bygones is not a constitutionally valid policy. If we got our government out of the way, how would you propose to fix this to desegregate America?
Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you very much, Gene, and thank you to the Soho Forum for inviting me to participate in this important discussion. Richard and I are going to disagree about a number of matters this evening, but we are not going to disagree about the history he recounts, the government's role in it, and its enduring impact. I am mystified by one who is so critical of government, having so much faith in the capacity of government to reverse the problems that he so brilliantly describes. There is simply no doubt that starting with Roosevelt's New Deal and for decades following, federal, state, and local government actively fostered and countenanced racial segregation in housing. One reviewer called Richard's story of that history a thorough and unsettling narrative that brilliantly corrects the historical record. I was that reviewer. So what am I doing here? But in the same review, I called The Color in Law less successful as a work of policy prescription. I still believe that as much as I admire the book. Federal housing insurance policies did, beginning with the New Deal, infect the housing market with race-conscious malware. The public housing program, which began in earnest in 1949 under President Truman, segregated blacks from whites, just as it occurred in the Jim Crow South. But we should not proceed, because of that history, to believe that nothing has changed in America since that time when those government policies were in effect. Indeed, the Harvard economist Edward Glaser and his colleague from the University of Washington, Jacob Victor, have found that based on census data, American cities today are more integrated than any point since 1910. All white neighborhoods, they write, this is based on census data. These are economists. They are not political advocates. All white neighborhoods are effectively extinct. Black ghettos continue, they report, but they have declining populations. Nonetheless, there is no doubt, and I agree with Richard, that the residue of government-enforced race segregation is with us. Ghettos may be smaller in population, but they persist. One can find large expanses of predominantly black, crime-ridden neighborhoods, impoverished neighborhoods, whether in Dallas or Detroit or Cleveland or Chicago, replete with low-value property, vacant lots, and few stores. It's an enduring irony that one can generally count on streets named Martin Luther King Boulevard as being the main drag of the sort of ghetto neighborhoods Dr. King fought so strongly against. Black suburbanization has reflected the welcome emergence of an increasing black middle class, but it is also true, as Harvard's David Cutler has written, that in addition to some self-selection, race-related housing patterns are reinforced by the fact that, as he puts it, whites pay more than blacks to live in predominantly white neighborhoods. That's because, on average, they can. The question before us, however, does not center on this past. How, if at all, should new government efforts seek to ameliorate the damage of previous ones? So in response to the expanded litany of government interventions in housing markets that Richard advocates, I'll put forward different policies that I hope you'll regard in a similar spirit of idealism. I know that I share that, and I did not enjoy having my views caricaturized as believing that black people lack a work ethic, because I never wrote that. I'll put forward different policies, and I'll maintain the following. As far as the goal of housing integration is concerned, government can best serve the interests of all African Americans by enforcing the Fair Housing Act, which prohibits racial discrimination in housing. Otherwise, government should let the private housing market flourish while also focusing on government's core roles, about which nobody disagrees, including keeping streets safe, providing for good schools, and the full range of public goods that make all neighborhoods good places to live. At the same time, local government should, and we agree on this, rethink zoning restrictions that all people, that hurt people of limited means, including African Americans. But the idea that the federal government can wave its magic wand and eliminate all localism in America is simply naive. If you agree with my analysis and proposals, you'll vote against the resolution that Richard is defending. For Richard, it follows from the shameful record that federal government should play an active role in fostering racial integration in housing through targeted interventions in the market. This view is misguided, in my view, for a number of related reasons. It ignores the surprising damage from such a government policy, including to the interests of African Americans. What's more, it ignores the fact that a private but well-policed housing market is actually the best way to penalize racism and foster integration, and the best way to enable all racial and ethnic groups to strive for financial security and upward mobility through home ownership. To elaborate, permit me to begin with some aspects of history which Richard does not emphasize. Let's travel back by time machine to St. Louis, 1950, before federal housing programs had been operating for so long, and especially before the widespread construction of public housing. It's a city whose housing history I researched in the context of a review essay about its infamous project, Pruitt-Igoe. St. Louis in 1950 was a city of about 850,000 people, 702,000 white, 154,000 non-white, who were classified as Negro. It was not a wealthy city. Median income stood at $2,700 a year, about $28,000 in current dollars. There were, to be sure, some predominantly black and predominantly white neighborhoods, but there are some surprises as well about those neighborhoods. For instance, in 98% black census tract, on the north side, 21% of the 36 homes were the property, that is, they were owned by non-white owners. 107 of them were multifamily units. Those are small businesses you're renting out. In another adjoining census tract, 96% black, 23% of all dwelling units had an owner present before government intervention. These were neighborhoods, in other words, in which African Americans owned property and were what? In a position to build the wealth we regret them not building now. Government denied them that possibility. The census data includes another surprise. Nearly 25% of St. Louis blacks, this was very much a southern city, nonetheless lived in majority white neighborhoods. Private housing markets disperse households based on their income and their ability to pay. And that's what was happening in St. Louis in 1950, as well as in Langston Hughes' neighborhood in Cleveland, which makes me mystified that you're looking to have the government come in as the cavalry. By the way, my grandmother went to high school with Langston Hughes in that high school. Government, she really did. Government, allegedly representing the interests of the poor, stepped in to interrupt this process. In the North Side neighborhoods in which blacks had been homeowners, government cleared the site for public housing, creating that black ghetto called Pruitt-Igoe. Residents there could not, by definition, become property owners. The St. Louis Housing Authority was the only possible owner. It's not just that government segregated. That was bad enough. Government denied anybody in public housing the right to build wealth. And with rents tied to income, the more you earned, the more you paid. How'd you like to have that deal in your apartment? Residents lacked the financial incentive to get out. Those providing private low-income housing, including many black property owners, were forced to compete against government-subsidized housing. African Americans, without doubt, faced discriminatory public policies, but they also had the particular misfortune to migrate from rural areas to urban ones at the same time as the misbegotten idea of public housing, much of which was built long after Levittown. Government-owned and operated, it reached its zenith. Even today, the more than 400,000 residents of New York City public housing, the nation's largest system, are denied any means to accumulate real estate wealth and must live in degraded conditions to boot. Why do we want to trust the government to fix these problems if it created these problems? In contrast, consider turn of the century, 20th century Harlem, where real estate covenants repeatedly unraveled as landlords opted to rent to blacks to maximize their own income. These examples illustrate economist Thomas Sowell's principle, profit trumps prejudice. The lesson here is this: private housing markets can and should be the vehicle of choice for helping all racial and ethnic groups in their quest for socioeconomic upward mobility. Unlike government housing programs, markets make decisions based on ability to pay. Branch Rickey figured that out with the Brooklyn Dodgers. Others were not willing to use the talents that were available, like Jackie Robinson. He got the drop on them by realizing that profit trumps prejudice. And I just dropped my note. No, I'm the speaker, not the comedian. Sorry.
Give me a 30-second break. Gotcha.
The Glazer and Vigdor findings that all white neighborhoods have become virtually extinct shows the virtues of a private sector-led approach. Again, this is not to assert that racially identifiable African-American ghettos do not persist, nor that African-American assets, when compared to those of other groups, are not less. The question is how to proceed in light of what we know in ways to benefit the largest number of people. I am skeptical for several reasons of Richard's well-meaning proposals, which he groups in his book roughly under the Obama-era name, Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. Scattering subsidized housing in what Richard calls higher opportunity areas, more affluent suburbs, brings with it significant complications in the real world. Richard first presents no evidence that this is a path clearly preferred by those who would be asked to play the role of serving as the fair share residents. He cites approvingly, for instance, the so-called inclusionary zoning policy of Montgomery County, Maryland, Well, I visited that program, and I met residents in that subsidized housing, which stands in the shadows of McMansions. They have these little houses. There are the big McMansions all around them. I met a young woman who complained, well, it's pretty good, but I have to make a long bus ride every Sunday back to the District of Columbia to attend my church. The New York Times reported recently on the increase in African-American parents in New York City in Afrocentric charter schools run and staffed mostly by people of color and which have, quote, New York Times, high graduation rates and standardized test scores at or above the city average. We're talking about the racial achievement gap. Continues the Times, the debate on how to deal with segregated city schools is incomplete if it doesn't take into account what black families themselves want. We must not discount their concerns or the idea that creating a minority diaspora may, even if it has certain economic benefits, would be targeted on the small number of people who could receive that benefits. Housing lots in Scarsdale, $300,000 to build on those for a unit. How many of those units can we build as a practical matter? There will be many, many people left behind in this projected policy. Moreover, let's consider African Americans who have themselves, because of their work ethic, climbed the housing ladder through employment, through savings. These people exist too. Let's not think of all black people as living in ghettos. And they've climbed up the housing ladder from apartment to two-family home to suburban single family. Others who have not made those sorts of constructive choices will, as per Richard's approach, in effect receive the same reward as those who did. Those people, when I have written about this subject, write me letters saying, I don't want to live next to a housing voucher household. I'm sorry that they say that way, but that's how they feel because they have scrimped and saved. In that context, those of us who are concerned about sustainable racial integration should mind the warning of the Dean of American Sociology, Herbert Gans of Columbia, himself a political liberal, who offered the following observation in his classic book, The Levittowners, focused on the Long Island community whose early segregation is part of the story Richard tells so well. Writes Gans, experience with residential integration in many communities, including Levittown, which is not segregated today, indicates that it can be achieved without problems when the two races are similar in socioeconomic level and in the visible cultural aspects of social class. I'm sorry that people feel that way, Richard, but they do. Moving poor households to affluent areas because those households are poor risks being counterproductive. We must keep in mind that those who believed in public housing and built more than a million such units around the country were also confident that their government program would aid and uplift the poor. What's more, inevitably, the scattered site programs Richard endorses would serve only that small number of households. Land is expensive, and dispersing a handful of households in costly homes in which median incomes are high might serve an abstract ideal of racial integration. As a practical matter, it would not do much for most of those in need. But do these arguments mean that nothing should be done today to uplift the African-American poor? No. But we must, in my view, adopt a different approach, that of doing our best to ensure that poor neighborhoods are also good neighborhoods. Where was it written that that can't be true? Historically, low-income urban neighborhoods have served as launching pads for ethnic groups who went on to become successful. But that is by no means an inevitability. Government must invest in what government should do, not intervening in housing markets in complex ways with unforeseeable consequences, but keeping neighborhoods safe through effective policing, providing essential public goods, clean parks, playgrounds, recreation centers, and effective schools above all. Segregation, all black schools are always inevitably going to be bad. I just don't know if you're really saying that, but if that's what you're saying, it seems patronizing to me. People of good faith will disagree as to how to provide good schools, charters, vouchers, or traditional public schools with strong parent and teacher associations. But they can be achieved. We're seeing that in New York. That's the revolution of the last 20 years with charter schools. Everybody can learn. Ask Jeffrey Cannon at the Harlem Children's Zone. Ask Eva Moskowitz at Success Academies. But safe streets and good schools are the prerequisite for upward mobility for the largest number. Vaulting a fortunate few to communities in which public goods are better is simply not enough and may be counterproductive. Where was it written, I repeat, that poor neighborhoods can't be good neighborhoods, that they can't be high opportunity areas? Nor can we blithely be confident that what Richard is calling high opportunity communities will act as such. Keep in mind that early public housing advocates assumed that in a clean apartment with good lighting, not a slum, children would prosper. This environmental determinism proved wrong. Good neighborhoods support the accumulation of skills, of social capital, of human capital. Good life decisions make for savings and other asset buildings. Private markets monitored so as to eliminate illegal race-based discrimination reward good life decisions as reflected in positive credit scores. As those factors work, we will see racial integration. We're already seeing it. And it will be sustainable. Richard has performed a great service by telling powerfully the story of malign government policies, but we should not seek to ameliorate their ill effects through new ones which pose their own serious risks. Thank you.
Five minutes of rebuttal for you, Richard?
Yeah.
Let me make a few points in response to Howard's comments. First of all, these are in no particular order, but things I noticed. The Glaser-Vigdor research that he talks about is quite misleading. It includes all non-whites as contributing to desegregation. The reality is that African Americans' exposure to whites has improved almost not at all, and the data that they find from increased integration comes mainly from the fact that low-income Hispanics have moved into all-black neighborhoods, so they're no longer all-black. Many white neighborhoods now have Asians and middle-class Hispanics in them, but very, very few African-Americans. We have not made the kind of progress in desegregation that Howard implies. Secondly, the most important point that I made, I hope, you will regard it as the most important, is the enormous wealth gap that these policies created. African Americans, as I said, have 10% of the wealth on average that whites have, even though their income ratio is about 60%. Nothing that Howard described that I could tell explained how we're going to close that wealth gap simply by the private market. Economists say that the intergenerational correlation of wealth overall for all families is about 0.50. That means it would take about a generation to have the wealth gap for the entire country. But the intergenerational correlation of wealth of African Americans is much, much higher than 0.5. So it might take 40%, 40 years rather than 20, even to have the wealth gap with no further government policy. But if we're opposed to government policy, most of the government policy that we now employ actually reduces the intergenerational wealth gap for African Americans. Social Security, minimum wage, policies that various social safety net policies that contribute to African American income and that shorten the time it would take to narrow the wealth gap. If we eliminated those as well, or narrowed them, or failed to support them and enhance them, the gap would go would extend even longer. Children prospered in public housing before white families, white working class families, were subsidized to leave public housing along with the jobs that supported both black and white families into suburban and rural areas.
What was left was neighborhoods of concentrated disadvantage where there were few jobs available, few good jobs available that could support families. I mentioned one, the actions of not only public housing authorities but welfare officials to remove husbands from public housing units, contributing to the single family, a single parent family intensity that exists in African American communities. Although, as we all know, I hope, the single parenthood is increasing among whites much more rapidly today than it is among African Americans. African American single family, single parenthood is not increasing. Whites are increasing at a phenomenal rate. We are having both a cultural phenomenon and an economic one. The problem is that we cannot reverse biology, but we can provide some families, middle class white families in particular, with the economic resources to support families, to support children without a two-parent household. African-American families without access to those jobs don't. Section 8 housing, by the way, is primarily not a program for single mothers with children. It's primarily a program for disabled and senior citizens. But of those African-Americans who do have Section 8 vouchers with families, they're almost all working. Most of them are working. About 10% are involved in the temporary assistance for needed families. And while not working, they are in job training programs or in educational institutions. These are not unmotivated people. I guess profit trumps prejudice. Okay, I guess I'm out of time. But
30 seconds. Go ahead.
Oh, well, that's all right. I
give you a minute. 60 seconds. Go
ahead. profit trumps prejudice. It's not the case that profit trumps prejudice. In 1960, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board was asked how come he didn't do anything to prevent banks from discriminating against African Americans in the way in which they issued mortgages, since the Federal Reserve was inspecting and very rigorously inspecting banks. He said, well, if any bank refused to lend to African Americans, others would seize the opportunities and lend to them instead, even though he well knew that every single bank in the country was refusing to lend to African Americans for housing.
Thank you.
It's worth keeping in mind that profit will not trump prejudice in a completely unpoliced environment. If everybody is allowed to discriminate, they will seek profit by doing so. But the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, not in 1960, so we have a changed legal environment since the time that that occurred. If we're talking about how to build wealth, and I think that is a key thing to worry about, how do we close that wealth gap? I do not believe it will happen by building subsidized public housing in the Scarsdales and where does Trump live in New Jersey? Whatever where he lives.
He has me over.
Bedminster. Tempting as that might be, right? That is not going to solve the problem because these are subsidized rental units. This has been the recipe for ongoing serfdom for poor people to be in these rental units subsidized. They have such a good deal they don't want to leave. The more income they make, the higher their rent goes. That's the rules of this program. And I'm really confused about why public housing was so good in the early days when there were all black and all white projects. If it was so good for white people and their children prospered, why didn't black people's children prosper? Because they were denied the possibility of upper mobility because they could never own property. Was the FHA wrong to discriminate? Yes, but public housing was just as wrong too, and we should not repeat that mistake, which Richard is inexplicably urging us to do. Inexplicably. Zoning is a really interesting issue, and he mentioned that before. Let me elaborate on that. We're starting to see local zoning come apart at the seams, and it's a really welcome development. It's going to be good for all people of modest means. In Minneapolis, there's a move to densify the single-family suburbs to allow the construction not of high-rise public housing projects, which are going to be guaranteed to foment the most opposition, but of two-family, three-family, small apartment buildings on corners. Even that is going to be hard for them to sell. the city council there is finding. But we're starting to see the iron wall of local exclusionary zoning crack under economic pressure because people can't have a place for their kids to move into. We're starting to see private economic forces undermine exclusionary zoning. The idea that the federal government will deny community development funds or mortgage subsidies to communities that are said to discriminate. You want to create a firestorm? That will create a firestorm. If you let local government say, wait a minute, this is not working, we've got to change it. Seattle's considered the same thing. San Jose is considering the same thing. I call it densification. Gradually, exclusionary zoning will wither away from economic forces in the private market. If we have heavy-handed government intervention, we will have controversy. It may feel good for the virtue signalers, but it will not get the job done. As far as Section 8 goes, 38, roughly a third elderly, a third disabled, and a third single parents. Not all black, of course. But it is a program in which single parents dominate. I'm not sure why we're talking about that exactly. But thanks a lot.
We're going to go now to the Q&A portion of the evening. Thank you both for your eloquent and impassioned presentations. I want to just start with by exercising moderator's prerogative to ask a couple of questions. Howard, I believe that Richard said that he does indeed, as you agreed, wants to roll back the zoning laws, the zoning restrictions that make it difficult for people to produce high rises for poor people. I think Richard also said that he wants to roll back or perhaps abolish, Richard, is that the mortgage interest deduction? Did I have you right? You spoke about that, I thought. No? Mortgage interest deduction. I thought you wanted to roll that back. It's a subsidy to white people in the suburbs.
I said it should. It can be.
Mike, please.
I said the mortgage interest deduction can be used as leverage to encourage suburban communities to desegregate. The specific proposal I have is that the mortgage interest deduction should be withheld from families in suburbs that, for example, maintain exclusionary zoning, among other policies that discriminate, but that the interest deduction should be placed in escrow and returned to those families at the point where their communities take steps to desegregate.
Okay, you clarified that. So that was my question for Howard. Do you support that idea?
Yeah. I find that to be breathtaking. So here I am. I'm a regular guy in Levittown, and I didn't vote for this discrimination. I had nothing to do with it. I moved in here, and you're telling me I'm not going to get this deduction because of something that happened before I even moved into this community. You're going to tell this community how it should vote. Now, maybe in an ideal world, that would make for something better. I can guarantee you, you would set off a political firestorm of incredible proportions.
Please keep the mic near you.
Right, and so let's be practical. Yeah. Let's be practical. Let's have HUD propose model zoning codes. Let's have the HUD secretary go around and promote those model zoning codes. Let's encourage communities, because they're starting to understand this already because of private economic pressure. But that kind of heavy-handed intervention denies the local tradition in America and is going to just create so much controversy, you're never going to get to where you want to go.
Well, I said explicitly that the policies I'm proposing that I described before are not politically realistic in today's environment. Of course they would create a firestorm. Excuse me, let me finish. Of course they would create a firestorm. So did school desegregation in 1954 create a firestorm. None of this change is easy, but once a political consensus evolves, they will become easier. They will never be easy.
Yeah, okay. And then now you may be able to respond later. Richard, my question for you, and you should probably keep the mic in your hand. Okay, it's good. And then if you could. But don't have to necessarily. Question for you, Richard. You sort of surprised me as a listener when you said, I hope you got my central point. It's all about the wealth disparity. You said 60% for blacks in terms of income and only 10% in terms of wealth. It's all about the wealth disparity. So the question in my mind then is, as Howard suggested, putting people in public housing where they don't own anything is not a good solution. But then more precisely, if the wealth disparity is the issue, why not just have a cash transfer of wealth to blacks? And then, for example, if they want some wealth, they don't necessarily have to buy a home. They could just buy some stocks and bonds. I don't own anything, any real estate, not any. I just have stocks and bonds. So that's my wealth. So give them more options. Just make it cash. It's fungible. If wealth is your concern, why not just have a referendum that says all whites have got to hand, all non-blacks have got to hand over a certain sum of money to all blacks? That's the central concern. Let's do that. Why not?
Well, I don't think you heard what I said
or heard
what I said before. I did not say that the way to solve the wealth gap was to put Section 8 vouchers or subsidized housing into suburban communities. What I said was one policy we could do to redress the wealth gap is to subsidize the purchase of homes for African Americans, qualified African Americans, in suburban communities that are today unaffordable to them, the same kind of subsidy that the federal government gave to white families that enabled them to move into those suburbs 50 and 60 years ago, but denied to African Americans. Mm. We didn't create the wealth gap by handing out cash to white families. We created the wealth gap by subsidizing their purchase of homes and appreciating communities.
Well, that's quite
right. We could
do
the same thing today.
Well, yes, but just let me repeat the question. That's one way. But if your central concern is the wealth gap, then isn't it most directly addressed wealth? Because wealth is not just housing. Lots of people are rich in stocks and bonds, and maybe they rent. What of it? They may have a few million in stocks and bonds or something else. So why not just have a cash transfer? Are you opposed to that? Why not? Doesn't that more directly address the wealth gap? Gives everybody options.
Well, the wealth gap is not the only problem. I said it's the chief problem.
Oh, okay.
I think, if you want to give cash transfers, you talk about a political firestorm, that would surpass anything I ever proposed.
Well, why not?
Because I'm trying to, I try to set forth a menu of policies, all of which would contribute to narrowing the gaps that we have and the segregation that we have. One of them would be to do a comparable thing for African Americans to what we did for whites, and that is to subsidize their purchase of homes in communities that today are unaffordable to them, but that would have been unaffordable to them had they been permitted to buy into it when whites did.
Okay, that's the end of my questions. Do you either of you at this point have questions for the other, or should we give it over to the audience? No. Okay. Audience questions. We're lined up, and please phrase your question as a question. You don't have to identify who you are unless you feel it's directly relevant to the question.
Long statement first, no? Okay.
Short statement.
It's actually Gene anticipated my question, which is, if the debate tonight is a debate between a compensatory view from Richard and a view that's a terrible idea and didn't work before, not going to work this time. If we just had a choice between two forms of compensation, which is Gene's question, but I'd love to hear from Howard and Richard, if it was, okay, same present value, some whatever. Larry Summers thinks it's the same present value. You're either going to have reparations and a settlement for all the bad stuff the American government did to black people over the last whole existence, or you're going to have an ongoing, God knows we're going to end the program, subsidy program that's going to distort the market and do other stuff, but it's going to be, Elizabeth Warren wants $40 billion a year of affordable housing. If the debate tonight was between, we have a choice, we need to do compensation, that's premise of the debate, but it's either we're going to do reparations or we're going to have a targeted, really smart blue ribbon panel housing program that will review every decade to see if we've gotten there yet. What do you both pick between those two? Because I'm surprised if we can't form some, we can't even get there on that. We have to do the
program. So a cash transfer or
it's your question, but it's slightly different. It's if the debate was we're doing compensation, it's either reparations or it's a decade review, housing targeted, blue ribbon panel, forever subsidy.
By reparation, you mean cash transfer.
Money.
How would you go first? Because Richard already answered it. What's your answer, Helen?
Well, my answer is that he's just proposed a different debate.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
Right. I wasn't prepared for that debate, but I will say this. I just don't think either of those is a practical solution. I'm sorry, that's a cop-out, but I'm not going to buy into either of those. I will point out, in terms of the distortions of compensation and credit support, one of the causes, there are multiple causes. The private sector did some crazy stuff in the 2008 financial crisis. But one of the problems was government-insured allocation of capital to families that were disadvantaged by virtue of their zip codes and their minority status. In the real world, again, that resulted in incredibly high default rates because of poor underwriting standards, because banks wanted to meet their quotas under the Community Reinvestment Act. This was a disservice to the people in whose name it was authored. So if I had to choose, if there were a reparations program that, how do you decide who gets that money?
You don't have to choose. Okay, Richard, did you want to make a comment? Go ahead.
I agree with Howard about this. The choice is a silly one. No. This is a complex problem, and it can't be solved with one or the other solution. No. But so far as the Community Reinvestment Act, this is a conservative trope that has been widely discredited. Most of the subprime lending that was exploitative, that was targeted to African Americans with terms that were far worse than the terms that were offered to whites, that resulted in exploding interest rates and defaults, were not issued by banks that were regulated by the Community Reinvestment Act. They were issued by private mortgage brokers, private mortgage companies, which were not covered by the Act. It did not require government quotas to get the private sector to exploit African Americans with the subprime lending outrages.
Well, okay, I'm going to rebut because I beg to differ. There was an element of people who took advantage of the spigot from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are government entities that made credit available willy-nilly, and no bank will tell you that they are not desperate to meet their community reinvestment standards by initiating loans, not necessarily having those loans be repaid. That is a disservice. I did journalism on this on the south side of Chicago, and I talked to homeowners who had the abandoned house next door to them. Their wealth was no longer being increased, and it was because of government intervention in the market, not despite it.
Next question. Thanks. Next question.
Hi. Yes, thank you. This question is going to be a little, I guess, New York-focused or large city-focused, and there's a second part, so bear with me for a hot second. First, what sort of approach do you think is appropriate with respect to ameliorating housing issues by upzoning, by moving policy around building to something like as of right per like what is allowed in zoning, or streamlining EIS processes or things like that to make it easier to build more housing in more places in cities like New York or San Francisco or whatever housing is very expensive. I guess the second part of my question is, how can either of you really justify any sort of policy proposal that incorporates mortgage interest loan deductions when that's effectively just a wealth transfer from working young renters like myself and many other people here tonight to fine gentlemen of distinguished age and accomplishment like yourselves?
Yeah, so Richard, you want to take that first? Maybe take the second question first, the second part of the question, because, you know, he's affronted you directly. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Howard. Let me think for a minute.
Hey, who's moderating this?
Well, I couldn't agree with the questioner more. I'm absolutely happy to give up my mortgage interest deduction. I think it is unconscionable. It's a distortion in the market. When NPR hosts say to me, well, how can you be opposed to public housing when you're in favor of mortgage interest deduction? I'm not in favor of mortgage interest deduction. So it's a sop to the home builders lobby. That's what it is. And it is an intergenerational theft of wealth. So I don't. Richard, however, needs it to use as a hammer in his policy. So keep that in mind when you vote.
Yeah, well, I just want to I just want to record for the record that the way to not take your mortgage interest deduction, Howard, is not to take it. So, but that.
I'm going to make a charitable contribution to Governor Cuomo instead.
Make the contribution to the SOA form. We can use the money. So, go ahead.
Well, you know, I agree with Howard. In principle, I think the mortgage interest deduction is completely unjustifiable, but it's there, and I would like to use what's there as what leverage we can to try to desegregate this country. It's an important tool that we could use. There's something about the mortgage interest deduction, I think, that we ought to call out, and that is the mortgage interest deduction is an entitlement. Whether they follow Gene's advice or not, any homeowner who meets the requirements of the mortgage interest deduction is eligible to take it. That's what we do for homeowners. What we do for renters is have a program that is an appropriation restricted. It's not an entitlement. That is, people who get subsidies for low-income renting aren't entitled to it just because they meet the requirements. The government appropriates a certain amount of money, and when the money runs out, you don't get it. So about a third of the eligible families who are on waiting lists, for example, for Section 8 vouchers, are the only ones who get it. Mortgage interest deduction, anybody who wants it can get it.
Next question.
I agree with that.
Okay.
And
too much.
You're going to create a new waiting list, by the way, if you start to build a limited number of subsidized apartments, if you think one-third is a small number for vouchers. But this just because of the Tax Reform Act, about 8% of Americans are going to itemize their deductions. That means they're not going to itemize the mortgage interest deduction anymore. They're going to take a standard deduction, and that's available to everybody in the country who pays income taxes. So we've just had an important change.
Interesting. Next question.
What about zoning?
Well, please.
I'll talk
please,
about it. He has please, to give me a chance.
Excuse me. If you have a question, you have to be up at the mic.
I have a question. I asked it before.
What? The zoning, I'm sorry. Oh, the zoning. Oh, sorry. What about the zoning? That was the first part of the question. That was two questions, but, you know, that's a little bit much. But okay. You want, if you've shouted out, it's a raucous crowd. You want to comment on the zoning?
Well, yes. We have lots of problems in this country. Racial segregation is not the only one. As I think you implied, there are young white people who can't afford housing either because of the housing shortage that we have. And one of the things that perpetuates that housing shortage is zoning that needs to be upzoned, that we need to stop restricting. Exclusionary zoning was established, as I document in my book, as a way of getting around a prohibition on explicitly racial zoning. It reinforces, it establishes, it perpetuates exclusivity, racial exclusivity that was created by the FHA. It should be abolished, but the only reason to abolish it is not just for racial reasons. It's because we have a housing crisis that affects young people, that affects professionals. We are not building a sufficient amount of housing to house people of both races and of all income levels.
Yeah. A few points about that. First of all, zoning is actually a residue from the progressive era. It was not invented to racially exclude, although it's been used to that effect. Progressives believed that industrial uses, commercial uses, and residential uses should be separated in a beautiful city. And in 1924, the Supreme Court, in its wisdom in Euclid v. Ambler, agreed with the progressives, and zoning spread like wildfire all across the country. Of course it suppresses building compared to as of right. The danger we have, first of all, the danger we have in New York is that zoning by permission of the mayor, that is, we'll relax the zoning if you do this, this, and this for us, that creates a new world of complications. For instance, in Brooklyn, in a Crown Heights area, which is bordered by minority communities, poor black people, and Orthodox Jews, there's a project going up. And the project gives priority to community residents in the Orthodox Jewish neighborhood because that's where that project is located. Zoning is still being used to racially exclude because it's at the sufferance of the government. If there were a general deregulation and as-of-right zoning were more the norm, you wouldn't have government trying to pull the strings that way, in which the upzoning is limited and conditional. And by the way, there's not a housing crisis except in San Francisco, Boston, New York, and Washington. There's no housing crisis in Buffalo. I'm from Cleveland. Believe me, there's no housing crisis. You can sell your parking space in New York and buy three mansions in Shaker Heights. I'm not kidding.
I sold my parking space for a lot of money, right?
Okay. But anyway, one short, well, I think is a correction. Howard is right that zoning to separate industrial and commercial uses from residential uses was a progressive idea, but the idea of separating single-family zoning from multifamily zoning came about after 1917, when the Supreme Court said you couldn't do racial zoning. Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover convened a commission to figure out a way around that prohibition, and the separation of single family from multi-unit zoning was developed as a way of perpetuating racial segregation.
Yeah. Next question.
Hi, good evening. So I heard tonight that there are about 1 million units of housing, public housing, built all across the country, and mostly lived in by black people. And
No, that's not true.
Oh.
Maybe 40%, maybe 40%.
Okay.
There are many predominantly black public housing projects, all public housing.
What is it, about 18% of the population are black and 40% in housing, so very disproportionate is your point. Yeah. Go ahead, yes.
Okay. Well, so it seems that one of the easiest ways to solve this problem is to give the units to the people who currently live in them. Thereby, you've transferred some wealth, and I don't know, they're not, you know, subject to the raising the rents and based on their income, et cetera. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, that give the units in public housing as a, you know, they own the, make it condos, they own the apartments. Your reaction, Richard? Yeah.
Well, as I said, public housing began as a middle class program. It was the most desirable housing available. It wasn't a disadvantageous. Children flourished of both races, both blacks and whites, flourished in public housing. The reason that African Americans changed their allegiance from Republican to Democrat during the New Deal is because they got some housing which was highly desirable. It was segregated. That was a negative aspect of it, but it was better than nothing. They were living many of them were living in deteriorated slum conditions, and public housing was a benefit.
Could you address the question?
But public housing deteriorated because middle-class families were evicted from it, both by subsidies, as I described, by the Federal Housing Administration, and then by regulations to provide housing for the poor and prohibit middle-class families from taking up spaces that could be occupied by the poor. Once public housing consists only of the most disadvantaged families, it can't be a healthy place to live. People's disadvantages reinforce each other. When public housing was mixed income, when it had middle class families in it, they were healthy places to live. And if we created mixed income public housing again today as one of the ways to solve the housing crisis, not just the racial housing crisis, but the housing crisis that affects all families today, that would begin to start us on the right direction.
But you know what?
I'm going to address the question.
Your answer is no to this.
He had his chance.
Just a moment.
That's right. My answer is no.
Just wanted to make it clear, Howard. Go ahead. No. Yes or no,
okay,
Howard?
People bring that up all the time. You're a conservative. You must want to sell these units to the people who live there. No, I call that lemon capitalism. Lemon socialism is when the Pennsylvania Railroad goes bankrupt and the government bails it out and creates Amtrak. That's called lemon socialism. It was a lemon. The government bought it. This is lemon capitalism. We let these units deteriorate to the point where they're the worst slums in New York, and then, wait, we're going to give them to you. This is great. Huh? Why would that be a good idea? I'll tell you what I would be in favor of, however, which is buy people out. Buy people out. You lived here 20 years. We'll give you $10,000 for every year you live there. We'll empty out the building. We'll sell the land to a private developer, and we'll get the city out of the public housing business once and for all. That's what I would be for.
Okay, next question.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. This question is for Dr. Rothstein, although either of you feel free to weigh in. Martin Luther King said, and I quote, "Many of us Negroes live above our means, spend money on non-essentials and frivolities, and fail to give to serious causes and organizations. Malcolm X said, and I quote, "The black man here, man for man, is forever the biggest consumer at the same time that he's the biggest non-producer." In 2016, the market research firm Nielsen found that black Americans, despite having less wealth than whites, are more likely to buy a luxury car and more likely to buy jewelry in any given year. So, in reducing the wealth gap, would you say is your chief concern? Do you see any role for discussing spending patterns in the black community?
I just tell you right now, I'm not going to touch that question.
It wasn't meant for you anyway. It's meant for...
Just saying, I'm not going to rebut because I'm not going to touch it.
Okay, nobody asked you. Okay, go ahead.
You know, we can use a little bit more virtue in all communities in this country. I don't think that focusing on African Americans is the way to begin.
And Howard refuses to answer.
Frankly, I wouldn't dignify it with a response to play it with that kind of broad brush. It's ridiculous.
Okay. Next question.
So, you've mentioned about the pernicious effect of government programs on housing, which is plausible and I think fairly well documented. I guess what's surprising is the level of harm which you're laying out, that public housing has affected minority populations, whether or not they were in communities that were in public housing, that it's responsible for the wealth gap, that essentially we screwed it all up by letting white working class people move to the suburbs. It would seem that there's a lot of natural tests there where we could prove some of those points or identify the level of harm. Have you looked at it as part of your studies?
Well, I didn't say we let white families move to the suburbs. We subsidized them to do so on an explicitly racial basis. And the suburbs couldn't have been created without government. As I said, as I described, you know, Leavitt could never have built Leavittown without government financing. No bank would be crazy enough to lend them the money to build 17,000 homes in one place. The only way you could do it was a government-insured bank loan to do it. So we didn't just let whites move to the suburbs. We subsidized them to do so. We created an apartheid system of housing with explicit government policy.
Howard, you coming?
You said before that no bank would ever have bankrolled Leavitt. To me, Leavitt is taking advantage of a program that's there. You know, do we know that absent the government program, he wouldn't have taken more risk, put more of his own money in it? I'm just perplexed that there's always a drumbeat, markets fail, markets fail. Markets won't support the banks. Markets won't invest in poor communities. Government has to twist the market's arm. I'm just not convinced by that. Do I believe that what you said happened and that he took advantage of the FHA? Yeah. You know, just like Donald Trump's father took advantage of rent stabilization in New York. Anybody that needs an apartment in New York would be crazy not to get a rent-stabilized apartment, even though it's a distorting and counterproductive policy. Would there never have been investment without that? Would people of means not chosen to move to the suburbs versus living in a government-operated project? You've been to the projects lately? You know, they have fences around all the lawns. It's like you're in a prison. Right, you don't mow the lawn. The government does that for you. You want to have a garden? No, you can't do that. It's institutionalized living. They didn't need a subsidy to want to get out of there. Anybody would want to get out of there.
Well, that wasn't the condition of public housing when the government created this subsidy. As I said, this was the most desirable housing available for working class families of either race, and only whites were permitted to do it. But we do know that Leavitt would not have been able to do it without the government. Prior to the FHA, there was no such thing as single-family homes for middle-class families. The only people who could buy single-family homes were the affluent because there was no such thing as an amortized 20- or 30-year mortgage before the FHA came in and created it. The only mortgages that were available were short-term, 5 years, sometimes 7 years, with a balloon payment, interest only, and no middle-class, working-class family could ever afford to buy a home on that basis. The only way that Leavitt or any of these other developers could build these subdivisions was with FHA support for the bank loans combined with an amortized mortgage of 20 or 30 years that permitted for the first time middle class and working class families, if they were white,
to buy single-family homes.
Yeah, but that ignores the fact that we had a banking market distorted by regulation. Banks could not branch across state lines. Commercial banks and savings and loans had distinct markets regulated by the government. We didn't have... who's the guy that advertises on late-night TV to give you a mortgage? The guy from Detroit. Who am I thinking of?
Don't know.
Okay. Anyhow, we now know because that market has been deregulated, private credit is flowing. The bank market of 1954, when William Levitt was building, was a constrained market, constrained by government regulation. So, was that a good thing? No. Was the FHA doing a good thing? No. But let's not mistake that for believing that private markets will not serve the interests of the housing market. That was the assumption of Catherine Bauer in her landmark book, Modern Housing, in 1936. She went to work for the Roosevelt administration after writing the book. She believed that the private housing market would, by its very nature, fail 2/3 of the population. It hasn't worked out that way.
Final question. I believe we have only time for one more question. You're the person, Sakatour.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I'd like to ask you a question. You mentioned the term scatterside housing. I wonder if you know that what that means going up in New York in the 1970s. It reminds us of Forest Hills housing. It reminds us of just north of New York City, Yonkers. Would your parents be different than that or what? I wait for both of you to answer. Thank you.
Did you understand the question?
Yeah. There have been a number of experiments, or not experiments, a number of efforts to create scattersite housing, and they've mostly been successful. Most of them are not high-rises. They're low-rise units scattered throughout communities where they're permitted, where there's not zoning restrictions on them, and they've been successful.
Howard? Yeah.
Well, I would differ in the policy because I wouldn't do it. So that would be a difference. But as far as them being successful, I believe you could probably sneak a few of these developments in with limited resistance. But, and this was my core point, how do you serve the best way the most people? It's not a few units for a fortunate few. It's serving the interests of the majority of poor people in this country, black and white, by government doing its job to keep the streets safe, to keep the schools good, to keep the parks clean. And scattered site housing is kind of beside the point.
That'll have to be a final question. Thanks, guys. So we now go to the final part of the evening, summary statements, 5 minutes apiece. Take it away, Richard.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to use this time to try to sum up my approach without dealing directly with the points that Howard has raised. Some people have criticized the approach I've described. They say that private discrimination, not government, was the chief cause of racial segregation. Residential segregation, they say, was well established before government got involved during the New Deal. And if so, then residential segregation is de facto, the common term, one we all use, not a government-sponsored system. And de facto segregation does not make government remedies obligatory. Indeed, current Supreme Court doctrine says that racially explicit policies are prohibited to remedy de facto segregation. Of course, private discrimination played a central role, and government at all levels was responding to the demands of many, probably most white voters, who insisted that discrimination be incorporated into government policy. But an unconstitutional system does not require that government was the only actor. Indeed, the Bill of Rights and the Civil Rights Amendments exist only to establish a requirement that government refuse to cave to private prejudice and private demands that government violate civil rights. If, for example, local ordinances in the South had not required segregation of restaurants, private establishments would have refused to serve black customers on their own. But when government endorsed the private bigotry with ordinances, it became an unconstitutional system that we were obligated to reform, even though private bigotry demanded it. For housing, the case is even clearer.
As I said a few minutes ago, William Levitt would have refused, well, I didn't say it, I'll say it now, William Levitt would have refused to build homes for African Americans on his own, even if government hadn't required it. He was a bigot. He wrote that he would refuse to sell homes to African Americans even if government hadn't required it. But when government required him to do so, it became a Fifth Amendment violation that we are required, unless we want to abolish the entire constitutional framework under which we live, that we're required to take steps to remediate. Notwithstanding what Howard has written, when whites did not suddenly discover suburban opportunities and then leap at the chance to leave their less motivated black countrymen behind, that's not how racial segregation was created. If it is required to do, the FHA had conditioned Levitt's and other developers' bank guarantees on a non-discrimination policy, our nation's racial landscape would look a lot different than it does today. Perhaps some bigoted white families would have refused to move into homes that were integrated. But the housing shortage was so great, as it is today, that for every family who refused, there would have been many wanting to take its place. The failure to act of the FHA to act in accordance with its constitutional responsibilities is one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. It would have been so relatively easy for us to have a different outcome, a different racial landscape today. I sometimes face questioners who say, my grandparents, as Howard said, weren't even in this country when these policies you describe were implemented. Since they came here, my family has worked hard to get where we are today. We're not responsible for these policies. Why should we now have to sacrifice, for example, with higher taxes or the removal of the mortgage interest deduction to fix it? I answer this in two ways. First, hard work alone could not have created a more advantaged white middle class. It took government subsidy to create it. We would not have middle class suburban subsidies today were it not for the FHA. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, were it not for the FHA, we would not have 20 and 30 year amortized mortgages, and homes would have been unaffordable to middle class families. It's only because of the FHA and later Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae that we have that system. Secondly, every American enjoys the privileges of living in this democracy. Every one of us does. Even if our forebears weren't here to fight to win our liberties in the Revolutionary War and in many other struggles since. But in addition to enjoying privileges of citizenship that our own particular ancestors had no role in creating, American citizens also share in the obligation to enforce our Constitution, including making sacrifices to remedy violations of civil rights that our own ancestors had no responsibility in committing. And so I hope all of you will join me in accepting this responsibility to remedy such violations, a responsibility that is a necessary complement to the privileges that we enjoy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard, and thanks for agreeing to participate in this debate. I said in my prepared remarks that I offered my comments, and I hope they would be taken in the same spirit of idealism that Richard has offered his ideas. And I do offer them in a spirit of idealism. As somebody who came of age in the 1960s, this issue of segregation has been in my life, in the public life in which I've lived that entire time, and it's terribly disappointing to see it remain so toxic and so with us. And so for me to be characterized as saying I believe that black people are less motivated than white people, I don't know where that came from, and I resent it. To say that I said that my grandparents worked hard, I didn't say that. I was talking about taxpayers in Levittown. I understand that it's easier to address a caricature of a conservative rather than this actual person who is here, but I'm not that person. The person that I am and the position I'm arguing for is one of concern for the aspirations of all Americans and doing what we can to put those aspirations forward. Nathan Glaser, the great sociologist at Harvard, went back and forth on affirmative action. First he was against it, then he was for it, tortured by it. It is a torturous issue. All these issues are torturous. Finally, he came around recently to saying, I just don't know what to do but to proceed as if African Americans are a minority like all other minorities because I don't know what else to do. We have to help make poor neighborhoods good neighborhoods. We have to help make all schools good. That will, in time, is it fair that the wealth gap exists? No, it's not fair. We simply can't wave a magic wand and make it disappear. No set of policies will make it disappear quickly. There aren't enough houses we can build that will close that wealth gap. We have to, and it was Lyndon Johnson who created Head Start with that in mind. It was compensatory. That's still a good idea, even though Head Start's not as successful as it should be. That's where we have to put our resources. Our limited resources have to go in making all neighborhoods good neighborhoods, to uplift all, to give them the options. When you look at Westchester County, which is under court order because of being said not to have done enough to promote housing integration, it's kind of ground zero for the policies Richard is talking about. If you look at the dispersion of families based on income, so there are median income in Scarsdale is about $250,000 a year. About 2% of African-American households in Westchester County earn $250,000 a year. 2% of Scarsdale families are African-American. That's the criteria we should use. If people who are roughly in line with the income levels in the neighborhoods in which they want to live, they should absolutely have the full force of the government to make sure they are not turned away from any house they can afford to buy or rent. But as soon as we start putting our finger on the scale, we are going to create more problems that we solve. Fundamentally, I'm confused as to why Richard, having given us this powerful litany of government-created problems, has so much faith in the government to redress them. I don't have that faith, although I deeply share his concern. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks to you both for very impassioned, very eloquent clash of views. The resolution, again, specifically is, since the federal government fostered housing segregation in the 20th century, the government should foster housing integration in the 21st. Is the vote voting over? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Those in favor of the resolution were initially 27.8%. Those in favor of the resolution ended up being 29% and change. So the yes votes picked up 1.4% of the vote. That's the number to beat. The no vote went from 52% to 66%, picking up nearly 14%. So the Tootsie Roll goes to the no vote. Congratulations to you both. And also, thank you very much. And also, Richard Rothstein will be selling the book that Howard Hussack thinks is a must-read. That's the one issue they both agree about, for $20. And guys, we have to come off the stage quickly before the groupies enter the stage. So thanks very much.